When we had meet the speaker time, a theme kept coming up. How do you write a book? And it was well-timed because part of how you write a book is how we look at Esther. If you're going to write a novel, you have plot, and you have setting, and you have characters. And so we're going to look at Hadassah and the plot and the setting and the characters. Thank you. Of her story. Hadassah is her Jewish name. We know her as Esther, but that's her pagan name. Hadassah was the given name. It means myrtle. And she's a reluctant heroine. She doesn't start out so great, which is like a lot of us. But she ends well. And that's the encouraging part. So we're going to look at her setting, at her plot and backstory, at the characters in her story. Now, I know you know this story. How many of you have watched a movie you like more than once? I think I've seen Sound of Music like 37 times, you know. And I still see stuff I didn't see before. So we're going to review the plot, but we're going to hopefully explore some things that maybe you hadn't noticed on a different time through. First of all, where is the setting? It's set in the capital of the Persian Empire. And it's at the beginning of the reign of King Ahasuerus, who is most likely known in history as Xerxes I. And it looks like it was around the 5th century B.C., about 100 years before Aristotle. And its events were probably written down somewhere between 15 and 100 years after they happened. We're not sure who wrote them. But her story answers the question, how did the Jewish celebration of Purim come about? Now, what question did we answer this morning? How did the 12 tribes of Israel come to be? Well, this story is answering another question about a Jewish festival that is still celebrated all these years later. The word Purim, Pur is Akkadian, and it means lot, like casting lots or like dice, and I-M is the Hebrew suffix to plural, so it's lots. Now, what they would do in Persia, on New Year's Day every year, they would lay out like a calendar that had 12 boxes, one for every month. And if they had events that were going to be scheduled for the year, they would cast lots to figure out what day they were going to hold this event. So when it was determined that the Jewish people were going to be slaughtered in a genocide, they hadn't set a date yet. And when they went and cast the lots for it, it fell on the farthest time away as possible, 12 months from now. So they had lots of time to be terrified. But they also had lots of time to call on the Lord. So what is the plot of Esther as a reminder? A plot to commit genocide against the Jews throughout the vast Persian Empire is thwarted by an orphaned, timid foreigner whom God puts in the right place at the right time with the right face. And the thwarting of that evil plot by this humble little untrained girl is still celebrated nearly 2,500 years later. I hope that encourages you. She's transplanted in another country. Sound kind of familiar? She didn't have a lot of social power, and yet God used little her to do something amazing. So who's the main character? Well, it's actually not her. She's a supporting actress. The protagonist is real, but he's invisible. And you don't really know until the end of the story who the protagonist is when you go, okay, this coincidence plus this coincidence plus this one plus this one. You know, it's kind of obvious. If I were to write this story as fiction, people would say it is too contrived. There are too many coincidences for this to be a believable plot. But since it was real life, I love one of the phrases from one of the archbishops of Canterbury who said, I believe in coincidence. I just think they happen a lot more often when people pray. So what's the preface or the backstory? It helps to see this story in light of all the history that's come before us. We're going to do a quick walk through the Bible. You have this man named Abram. He's promised given a promise from God that he and his wife will make a great nation, and you can interact with me here. So what's the obstacle there? Got a little fertility problem. Sarah says, maybe this is the month. Okay, maybe this is not the month. Okay, maybe this is the month. Well, it's not the month. For more cycles than I ever went through, and I felt like my decade was plenty long. She went through it for a very, very long time. But eventually you have Abraham, you have Isaac, and then Jacob, whose story we reviewed this morning. And then you have Joseph, that son of promise. He goes down into Egypt during the famine. Well, actually, he's sold to Egypt, and his family joins him during the famine. And they start out with a lot of social power, but through the centuries, they end up being the slave people in Egypt. And you know the story, let my people go. 500 years later, God raises up Moses to lead Abraham's descendants out of bondage back to their promised land. And the Lord leads them at that time through people called judges. But the people say, oh, we don't like judges. We want kings. Everybody else gets a king. Why can't we have a king? So God says, okay, fine. You can have a king. They have Saul, David, and Solomon. And under those three kings, the nation is all one nation. But it's divided. The north then goes to become Israel, and the south is called Judah under King Rehoboam, who is Solomon's son. So you have this divided kingdom, and then they're destroyed. The people are carried off to captivity. The Assyrians come in and take over the north. The Babylonians come in and take the south, and they carry everybody away to captivity. And then Cyrus the Great takes over Babylon. And we get the story in 2 Chronicles 36, 11 through 23. If you have your Bible, turn with me there. If you don't, I'm going to project it for you. 2 Chronicles 36, 11. Second Chronicles 36:11. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king. You see that? He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke for the Lord. And he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear allegiance by God. But he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord God of Israel. Furthermore, all the officials of the priests and the people were very unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they defiled the house of the Lord, which he had sanctified in Jerusalem. And the Lord, the God of their fathers, sent word to them again and again by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they continually mocked the messengers of God, despised his word, scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of God arose against his people, until there was no remedy. Therefore, he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old or infirm. He gave them all into his hand. And all the articles of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his officers, he brought them all to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all its fortified buildings with fire, and destroyed all its valuable articles. And those who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the prophet, the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout his kingdom, put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's appointed me to build a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go. You can go home now. So you got the picture? They can go home. Unfortunately, some choose to remain, and Mordecai and Esther are among those group people. We don't know exactly why they were still in Persian territory, but they were. So that's sort of a head-scratcher. Cyrus is then succeeded by Darius, and then you have Xerxes. Just to give you a picture, I've got the ancient and the modern, so you can get a sense of just how big. This guy had some real estate, okay? And we are in Susa, the capital, which is smack dab in the middle of Iran. Shushan in Hebrew. One of several capitals of the Persian Empire. It's the best known capital, of course, is Babylon. But this was the winter palace. It got a little too hot in the summer. Historians say that reptiles crossing the road would fry. It was so hot. This makes Texas look cool. Today, it's nothing but ruins, but for centuries, it was one of the oldest cities in the world. And a fire destroyed it after Xerxes, and then the Persian Gulf War sadly further destroyed the city. But some things we need to know. One of the things we learn about Persian law is from Herodotus, who's the father of history. Now, the father of history doesn't do history like we typically do history today. When we pick up a history book, we expect sort of a chronology, and we expect it to be fact-based. Okay. Now, Herodotus, there's a little mythology, and then there's a little bit of fact, and then there's a little bit of mythology, and it's sort of all mixed together. And that's actually the way a lot of the ancients told history. But one of the things that he records that's very helpful for us in understanding the book of Esther is he gives some rules that developed under the Median kings, who were later the Medes and the Persians came together. And he says, the first of the Median kings introduced for the first time the ceremonial of royalty. And here's what it was. Admission to the king's presence was forbidden, and all communication had to be through messengers. Now, remember when Esther goes into the throne room, and she's like, I can't go in there unless he, you know, he's going to kill me unless he puts out his scepter. And so we tend to read this like, well, he'll probably kill her, but he probably won't because he, you know, he'll do the scepter thing. The law was, you don't come. It wasn't, you can come unless the king decides to let you. It was sort of a very teeny tiny footnote. Well, I mean, there is one way you could be saved, but I don't recommend trying it. Okay, because like probably nobody's ever done it. Who would be stupid enough to just walk into the throne room? So she really thinks she's going to die. I mean, by the time she decides she's going to go in there, she really thinks, you know, what choice do I have? But we're getting ahead of ourselves, aren't we? We know the Persian law. Something else we need to know is God's law and what he has said about a couple of things that we seem to be missing in the lives of Esther and Mordecai. The first is you're not supposed to marry those pagan peoples because they worship other gods, and those other gods will turn your hearts away. So this is not acceptable. The other thing he says is, well, there are these food laws, and you need to be a set-apart people. You need to be holy like me, and one of the ways that you show you're holy is by living according to those food laws. Now, isn't it interesting that nobody knew Esther was Jewish? What does that tell you about what's going on with the food laws in Esther's life? Not there. So it's not really overtly stated this girl was not really a law keeper, but you kind of put two and two together and go, okay, there was not kind of maybe a chameleon thing going here. And she looked so much like the culture around her that nobody would have guessed she was Jewish. Now compare them with Daniel. Remember Daniel's off in Babylon? It said Daniel made up his mind he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. So you can see when you look at these two people in captivity, you have one person, Esther, who's doing what's sort of to be expected. I mean, it's a lot to ask. Excuse me for just a second. My soup was a little salty tonight. Tasted good, but suddenly I'm thirsty. You have Esther who is looking just like the culture, and you see the contrast of Daniel, who's also in captivity, and he is finding a way through great creativity, I might add, to say, well, I'll do the job you're asking me to do, but could I please have permission to at least try God's way and see if it works? So again, by contrasting these two lives, you can see that there was some compromise going on here. So she starts out hiding her identity. And that is a really important thing for us to consider. Because sometimes in a sick world, it's easy for us as believers in the Lord to say, but I don't want to stand out too much because they'll think I'm a freak or they might persecute me. But God says, I want you to be set apart. I want you to be holy. I want you to be different. Well, let's look at her husband, Ahasuerus. Now, we look at history and we say we've never heard of a guy named Ahasuerus. But when you pronounce his name aloud in Hebrew, it sounds like King Headache. And I think what may have been going on here is the author's having a little fun. Okay, so we got this King Headache guy. And it may have been that it's a stage name or just a description. He reigned for 21, Artaxerxes, who we're pretty sure is who we're talking about, reigned for 21 years. And he was known to have invaded Greece with a huge army, but only about 5,000 returned. So probably in the beginning of the story, when you have this big banquet going, he's getting ready to go off to war and he's going to win. And when he gets back and he's pining for Vashti, it's probably because he's been like royally defeated and has a teeny tiny little army on his way back and he's lonely for his woman. It was after this disastrous Greek campaign that he chose Esther as his queen. I think it's also why he was very interested in somebody adding to the treasury. And we'll get to that in a minute. Let's notice something about his attitude about monogamy. He says, go round up all the virgins. And then later, after Esther becomes queen, there's this little teeny phrase that says, when they rounded up the virgins for the second time, So it's not like this love story. It's more like this guy had a little girl problem, and he's not this great love hero that we sometimes make him to be. Herodotus also makes mention of Xerxes' illegitimate sons. So he had a little problem with that, but he also had a pretty cavalier attitude about the genocide of his own subjects. When Haman comes to him and says, hey, these people are annoying me, so I'll give you a big heap of money to kill them, he's like, okay, whatever, sure. These are his loyal subjects, and he doesn't seem to ask a whole lot of questions about what's going on. He just accepts it. So let me emphasize, because often you'll see movies of this great king and this girl so pretty, and she comes in and she wins his heart, and the two of them walk off together into the sunset. And so when she appears in the court, of course, because he loves her, it's not exactly what happened. I think there's true terror when Esther says, he hasn't even summoned me for a while, if you catch my drift. It's not like we're best friends. It's not like I'm even his favorite. You don't realize what you're asking me, cuz. All right, the story. Let's review the story, and you're going to help me review the story because you know this story. All right? Starts out, the king throws a banquet before his campaign, right? And what does he say his wife needs to do? Anybody remember? Vashti? Put on your royal crown. Very close. Come and show off your crown. Now, some of the historians believe he was asking her to wear only her crown. There is some evidence of that. Okay? There are some historians who think that this was their wedding feast. There are others who say, no, probably it was 9 months later, like she was pregnant, and he's wanting her to parade pregnant. So we don't know exactly. But here's what we probably shouldn't do with chapter one. We shouldn't take chapter one and say, this is really important teaching on marriage. And here's why. Here's why. Because we are so well-versed in observation, interpretation, application, that we take chapter one and say, okay, I've read a chapter for the day, I need to apply it to my life. Well, there's a little problem with that, with narratives. That works great when you have Paul talking about, like, rejoice always, pray without ceasing. It has real direct application. When you take a narrative, you have to read the whole story before you start looking for the point. Otherwise, let's say you took the story of the three little pigs, okay? If you stop after the first panel, you can say, wolves are bad. They can kill you. But you miss the whole point of the whole story. So we have to read the whole story of Esther and then start going, oh, God is the protagonist. Oh, God is faithful. God is loyal. But it's a bunny trail to try to make this a teaching on marriage, because it misses the main point. And I think there's a reason we are not told a lot of commentary about whether Vashti was innocent or whether she's guilty, because that's not the point. And the biblical writers are very good about staying focused on what they're trying to communicate. So he tells her to parade. She doesn't. And he calls his counselors together, and they're going, whoa, dude, you have to do something, or we're going to have all the women in the kingdom rebelling, so you're going to have to make an example out of her. So Vashti's out of the picture. And so he comes back from this failed campaign, and he's pining, and he says, I need a queen. It's not that he doesn't have any women. Okay, he's got a couple of harems going, but he wants a queen. So that's where Esther gets included in the roundup. And I do believe to some degree she was a victim, and that they just went out and got the virgins. And again, there's a part of you that says, well, you would hope a person of faith would run, hide, you know, take a stand. Don't know. But the fact is, he had a whole lot of power. And so she's brought in, and she finds favor with the eunuch who's over all the virgins. Now, why do you suppose they had eunuchs with the virgins? The queen, the king's virgins. This is a no-brainer, right? Yeah. Because you can imagine if somebody impregnates one of the king's women, the king would think it's his baby, rises up, and pretty soon you're looking at a coup. Okay? So the king's had eunuchs around their women, and you also see more and more limited access for Mordecai. And I think this is why men didn't have access to the women for that reason. But anyway, Esther finds favor with the head eunuch over the women, and so he starts, you know, helping her out with the cosmetics, saying, I know, you're going to be the one. We know how to make you the one to be the most pleasing to the king. She's preparing for her night with the king, okay? Do I have to spell this out? I don't think they were going to, like, say, what scroll did you read last week? You know, I don't think this is the kind of conversation that was going to be going on when Esther had her night with the king. On the other hand, it's not like Esther is this loose woman who slept around. Okay? When you become the king's woman, you are committed to the king for life, even if he doesn't make you his wife. You're part of his harem. If you get chosen as queen, you get to do the wife thing. But otherwise, you're more like a concubine, but you're still dedicated to one man. So while we see some compromise, I don't want to paint a picture that Heather is... Heather's my niece. That Esther is this, flagrantly immoral woman either. There's just a lot of compromise going on here. All right, so Esther has her night. She's the winner of the pageant. She's chosen. And like I said, shortly thereafter, they have the second rounding up of the virgins, and she, doesn't really have a lot of interaction as far as we can tell. But at some point, Mordecai overhears a plot to kill the king, and he gets word to Esther that this plot is going on, and it's uncovered, and the guys who are doing it, are taken care of, and it's written down in the annals. You know the story. But how do they award Mordecai? They don't. Nothing happens, which is a pretty big oversight. Have you ever been overlooked? Maybe you were overlooked sometime. Maybe it isn't the time yet to be vindicated, but I digress. Anyway, the story is written down in the annals and sort of forgotten to some degree. But the king is saved, and then Haman comes along, and Haman really, really hates Mordecai because everybody else is saying, Haman, you're the man. You are so great. And Mordecai is saying, I ain't bowing to you. I am not bowing to you. I sound like a Texan, and I ain't doing that. I am not bowing to you. Well, my sister, I'll digress a minute. My sister moved from Washington State. She goes, we don't say ain't, even slang. I'm sorry, you sound like a hick when you say that. Do not say ain't. So here I am saying ain't. I ain't doing that. All right, so he is not going to bow to Haman. And it's possible that it was a religious thing. It is possible that he said, my God is Yahweh. But I think it's more likely it was a nationalism thing, where he's just saying, no way, I am bowing to you and acting like one of your captors. At any rate, Haman is really angry. And Haman doesn't care that everybody else in the kingdom bows or that he's the king's right-hand man, because his pride is making him really angry. So his wife gives him some really lousy counsel and says, take care of him, he's just a little fly, you can squash him. So Haman goes to the king and says, you got this whole group of people we want to kill. And the king says, okay. Now, there are a couple different interpretations of what the offer is. Some people think that when Haman came and offered the money, the king said, no, keep the money, that's okay. But there's another way to read that. You can read it as if the king says, hey, it's your money. What it says is the money is yours. And I think it's more like saying it's your money. Hey, if you want to spend your money that way, fine. Because the king had very little money in the bank at this point. And Esther says, my people have been sold alive. And she even mentions the amount, which might suggest that they knew there was money on their heads if they were going to be destroyed. At any rate, to make a long story less long... Haman has got this plot in motion, and Esther hears about it. She starts mourning. Mordecai notices she's mourning, and he finds out what's going on and says, basically, you have to go talk to the king. And that's when she says, you don't understand. You don't understand. I can't walk in there. He hasn't summoned me. I'm a dead woman. And Mordecai, I think, threatens to out her. Because he basically says, well, you're going to die if you don't. Well, how's she going to die if nobody knows she's queen? Knows she's Jewish. I think he's basically saying, I think you were born for this. And deliverance will come from somewhere, but why not let it be through you? So she dons her royal robes, which is very important. And we'll come back to that. She puts on a robe, and she acts like the queen that she is. And she walks in. And I'm sure she's going to die. And the king puts out a scepter and says, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. Now, that is idiom for I'm inclined to give you what you want. No fool would actually ask for half the kingdom. But he's basically saying, I'm feeling favorable toward you today. What is it that you want? She says, I want you to come to a banquet and I want you to bring Haman with you. So they come, and the king knows she's got something on her mind, so he asks her at the banquet, what is it you want? And she said, come back tomorrow. So Haman goes home, and he's feeling pretty good because he's been invited to the queen's banquet. And so he has this gallows built for killing Mordecai. Now, when we think of a gallows, we might think of a place where people are hung like this, but the word is really tree, and they spiked people. Sorry, they killed them and then spiked them as an example. So they're up very high in the sky, spiked, impaled, and it was a way of saying, don't mess with me, or this will happen to you. So he has this installed for Mordecai, and that night the king can't sleep, and it just so happens that he says, what's a good cure for insomnia? I know. Who was it today who told me your cure for insomnia was reading a medical, or what was the article you said? See, yeah, and it worked, right? Yeah. Okay, so same kind of deal. The king is saying, read me my annals, I can't sleep. And don't you know, it just happens that they read the story about how Mordecai saved his life. And he said, well, what do we do? Where's the part about what I did for him? And it's not there. I need to honor this guy. So here's the king waking up in the morning saying, how can I honor him? While Haman's going in going, I'm going to kill him. They're both thinking about the same guy. I love the irony here. And so the king says, what shall I do for somebody I want to honor? And Haman's going, yeah, let me tell you how I would want to be honored. So he thinks the king is describing him, and he comes up with the most over-the-top way to be honored, only to then be told, then you get to go do that for the guy that you don't like. So God has such a sense of humor. So at that point, I think Haman starts figuring out, I'm probably a dead man. And his wife kind of seems to agree with that. Things have changed here. Something's wrong. At any rate, they go to the banquet the next day, and Esther tells her husband, my people and I have basically been sold. He's like, who would do such a thing? She's like, the evil Haman. And he's so upset, he leaves the room. Haman falls on the couch. Now, remember what I told you about guys near the queen? It's unthinkable for him to be falling on her couch begging, but he's known he's a dead man. Well, the king comes walking back in, sees what then looks like sort of an accosting of his wife, and he's like, you're totally a dead man. And they go off and they kill him, and they put him on the same gallows he had installed for Mordecai. Again, this little poetic justice thing that God is up to. So here's some things I want us to notice about this story. Because in the end, not only are God's people saved, now the Persians couldn't revoke, to go back on something they decreed. So he basically said, well, you're allowed to fight back. And in the end, a whole bunch of the Jews' enemies are killed, and none of the Jews are recorded as being killed. But what's significant here is that Esther is called the queen only two times in the first four chapters. Very, very sparse references. Until that minute when she puts on her robe and acts like who she is. She is not the wife of the king. She is the daughter of the king. And when she starts acting like she's going to go to this man on behalf of God and his people, then suddenly the author starts calling her Esther the Queen Esther, Esther the Queen, Queen Esther. She gets called what she is when she starts acting like who she is. Now I want to just review some of the it just so happens coincidences in this book. You got the king demanding his wife appearance. You've got the queen refusing, which provides a perfect opportunity for this beautiful girl to come along. She's received favorably. God grants her favor both by the eunuch and the king himself. You have her then finally chosen as the one. You have Mordecai just happening to be in the right place at the right time to overhear the plot. You have him happening to have access to Esther so he can get word about it. You have his loyalty recorded. You have the die thrown at a time that gives the most advantage in terms of the most time to plan. You have Esther's unexplained delay in having a second banquet, which just happened to give enough time for the king to get insomnia, to just happen to be reading the Chronicles the night before, which just happened to be about the story of how Mordecai saved his life. Haman just happens to arrive at the palace when Mordecai is on his mind at the very time the king wants to honor. You see this going on and on and on? Like I said, if I were going to write fiction, it would be way too contrived, because real life doesn't have this many coincidences. So even though God is never mentioned once by name in this book, his hand is all over the place. Some vital statistics to remind you about in Esther. The number of times God is mentioned, 0. Number of times prayer is mentioned? Zero. You do have fasting, but you don't have prayer. Number of times the temple or Jerusalem are mentioned? Zero. Number of times God's purposes are thwarted in Esther? Zero. So what do we see? Once you've seen the whole story, you say, here is this nation. Remember we read in Chronicles how sicko and bad off they were, so God had to allow them to be taken into captivity. You have these people that for whatever reason have not gone back to the promised land. They're still stuck in Persia, and they appear to not be living any differently from the culture. But the God of loyal love to his people Israel shows up and rescues them and saves them from genocide. The Almighty Lord is sovereign in all his dealings, despite the disobedience of his people. And he kindly cares for his people despite their compromises. It's not that he doesn't care about their sin. He cares deeply about their sin. It's that their sin doesn't affect how much he loves them. And it doesn't affect his promises and his faithfulness. Those are going to be true no matter what. God's purposes are not thwarted even by sin. I don't know how he does that. Shall we continue in sin that grace might abound? May it never be. But as we saw this morning, you got these two bickering sisters, and yet we have the 12 tribes of Israel. Here you have these people that don't seem to be honoring God, and yet God is continually working out the circumstances to show his loyal love and his faithfulness once again. Even when they sin, it doesn't stop him from keeping his promises. So what can we conclude from all of this? We can conclude, once again, that God is good. We can conclude that God loves us. He loves his people. We can conclude most certainly that God is in control. Now, don't you know they were looking around at times saying God must have forgotten us? God has abandoned this place. There is no fear of God in this place when God was so present. You know, sometimes I forget I have my sunglasses on top of my head and I look all over for my sunglasses and I can't find them, but they're imminently present. It's like that with God a lot of times. We are looking all over. We can't see him at work, and he's so close, we can't even notice that he's right there. Sometimes it will look like he's not in control, but he's totally in control. And the time when it looks like God is most not in control is an especially good time to yield to God and to obey his purposes. And God can use even our failures for his glory. That was so beautifully illustrated by our sister. Thank you. Even our failures can be turned, when God gives the victory, can be turned into a beautiful victory song where God has taken sin and turned it around and made it about his glory and his grace. If God could take the murder of the second person of the Godhead and turn it into the greatest beauty of history, what sin can we commit that God cannot redeem? Shall we continue in sin that grace might abound? No. Nevertheless, where sin abounded, grace abounded more. So it keeps coming back to this question, doesn't it? Will you trust him? Is God good? Will I trust him?